Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 75, section 6, which is old single column, page 844. Okay, we have basically as I was hinting right at the end of the preceding session, we have the final severe immediate consequence to deal with yet that they bring out in this next section. It's a very weighty situation when you pull out a heavy line from the book of Proverbs. It all sounds so straightforward. Adam and Eve leave the garden, but we all know it. It quickly becomes
hop on the bus.
It becomes very severe. Yes. I suppose all we have to do is just remind ourselves that, everything fell apart. Remember, we've just gone through the direct fact of the default and Adam joining in with Eve, doing likewise, them giving a few more of the parallels with the story in Genesis, either in kind of a direct way or sometimes in a very indirect way, you can see how there were events that are captured, in a basic symbolic essence anyway in the Genesis story. And so we ended with that tension. That the Genesis story, has supposedly between the serpent and its kind and Eve and her kind, but no, it's actually between the Noddites and the Adamites. It's between Serapeitia's kind and Adam and Eve's kind that, you set up this long-standing tension, because remember, immediately the garden dwellers went out and massacred every man, woman, and child in that Noddite settlement that was right there on the mainland, off the neck of the peninsula there. So let's see what happens here next with that tension, and then we'll get the other shoe will drop with Adam and Eve, the consequences for them.
Section 6, Adam and Eve leave the garden. When Adam learned that the Noddites were on the march, he sought the counsel of the Melchizedeks. But they refused to advise him, only telling him to do as he thought best and promising their friendly cooperation, as far as possible, in any course he might decide upon. The Melchizedeks had been forbidden to interfere with the personal plans of Adam and Eve.
And we're all, who've been reading for a long time, quite familiar with that basic concept, but you can hearken back to the first time you read that and how much tension there is there, and various modes of idealistic thinking, non-evolutionary thinking. We would think that there would be all this help that we brought to bear. It's already on the planet, remember why you feel such a tension with the fact that the Melchizedeks had been forbidden to interfere, things like that in the book. For all of human history until the fifth epical revelation, the only concept of God that we'd ever had revealed to us was basically God the Father. And, the nature of God the Father is that he is inherently the God of transcendence. God without. And every relationship that the Father has is this very definitive from without intervention within sort of a phenomenon. You know, and we've rationalized everything in human history that we thought God was involved in that mode, that interventionary mode. You know, so we think that's just the way it is. Yeah, and adding a whole hierarchy, we would just immediately, well, it's not just there's this one being. We have a whole hierarchy that's going to be a downstepped expression of the Father, and it's going to be a whole hierarchy of intervention, right? Instead of just an absolute intervention from the top. But you know, if you think about it logically, you know, if there has to be lots and lots of intervention, that would mean that the source of everything, existentially, the God the Father, is not the greatest at planning, right? You know, he kind of just, you know, the first thing that popped in his head, he sort of threw it out there, and then he's just kind of, you know, flying by the seat of his pants and has to intervene all the time. And, you know, remember, that's the stories.
And circumvent free will, too.
Right, yeah, right, exactly. And then, you know, he'd be, you know, interfering with free the exercise of free will. But, yeah, I mean, you know, we know that this is the way that humans have always rationalized everything, that this very anthropomorphic God. Like, no. you know, start with his ideal, his infinite and eternal nature. Okay, there's not the slightest, you know, in absoluteness, in infinity of undotted I's or uncrossed T's. I mean, it's all, you know, infinitely, completely planned. And you go, well, then why would there ever be an intervention? Well, John just brought it up. One of the things that the Father intervened, that he threw in to the inside, was personality, free will. So, but, you know, I mean, the general rule of thumb for, you know, what we might call in general the celestials engaging the humans is, you know, the non-interference directive like Star Trek. Right? I mean, that's the basic mode. Even, you know, yeah, you go, yeah, but they're on the planet. Yeah, but they're not, they're here, but they're not, you know, in a father-like mode, micromanaging things. It doesn't matter, you know, who you're talking about. You know, all of those individual hands, if you will, of God, all humbly work under the context of the God of evolution, experiential deity, God the Mother, and you know, that action of the individuality of the whole, you know, gets you know, stands first in how everything plays out. Everything else is subservient to that, and that's what rebellion is not acting in that mode. Acting as if you the part, are superior to the whole. And that's what rebellion is. So, you know, you think about how much help, not just the Melchizedeks, but all the other, I mean, the author of this paper, how much help they could have given. But that would be fundamentally, you know, as you saw right at the end there, interfering with free will, interfere with the personal plans of Adam and Eve. You know, they'll interfere with the functioning of mind in some animal or something. Okay, that's irrelevant. You know, or even the degree to which we're not really doing anything personal, we're just fancy animals. Okay, that can be, you know, monkeyed with all, you know, as much as you want. Pardon the pun there, but you know, but free will, right, is a different matter.
Though they cooperate,
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly not going to be antagonistic.
Theme comes up a lot in the Aramaic book in very many different places. Yeah, yeah. You know, like when Jesus said, whatever you guys decide,
that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven, and, you know, things like, statements like that. And like you're saying, the apostles, you know, even just letting the apostles, you know, figure it out and not interfering. And, you know.
The guy who was up in the hills, what was his name? Fortune, the guy who, mm-hmm. you know, you've Fortune. Got a great mind, you know, in your body, but doesn't do any good while you're sitting up here in the hills.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. Get out there and, you know.
Yeah. Get, you know, God can't steer a parked car. Get out there and start driving. And, you know, we'll work with you dynamically along the way. And you had something to do?
But they did give a lot of advice before the default.
Yes.
So I'm thinking that they had to experience the full impact of what they did. And there went the advice.
Yeah, yeah. So let's
Polonia in particular.
Right. We know that the big exception to what I was just saying are the descending sons that come, you know, to inaugurate a new dispensation on a world. I mean, you know, it appears to be a very profound insertion into the natural process of things to have some, you know, like say maybe it's a paradise son of some sort, you know, just appear on a world. But again, you know, as we stress so many times, those are all very precisely planned to be in cooperative subordination to the whole. And, you know, and that's why we have a default now. I mean, even, you know, with all of that, Melchizedek's helping out Adam, you know, that's all in the context of them doing what fits into the big picture. The moment they did something where they were putting themselves as a part above the whole, no matter how trivial it might appear to be, you know, that's an issue.
Even Jesus, who was God incarnate,
mm-hmm.
People who saw him just saw him as a man.
Yeah.
The only way they could recognize that he was God was with their insight. Mm-hmm. They couldn't see that.
And, you know, not only that, was, you know, him being, you know, not manifesting his godhood, you know, in a definitive fashion, you know, talking about Jesus, but then just think about, you know, what I was just saying, it doesn't just apply to creatures, that cooperative subordination to the whole. It applies to creators, too. Michael of Nebadon, master son, knows that he's not the whole. There's, you know, an infinite amount of bigness above him, right? Grandness, you know, immediately of the finite, you know, and beyond that. I mean, he may be a master son, but he's not the master universe. Or those who are personalized deity relative to that vast domain, architects of the master universe, say. Right? I mean, he knows he's way down in the, you know, on the totem pole, or, you know, even relative to the ancients of days. Right? I mean, there's 100,000 local universes, you know, in one super universe. Right, I mean, the ancients of days have a bit bigger scope than a creator's son, even as a master's son. Right, and he knows that very humbly, knows his place in a much bigger picture. So, you know, it's the thing that, you know, like I keep stressing, that is fundamentally what's being added in the fifth epical revelation, the whole. And the individuality of the whole. Previous revelations have talked about parts, you know, and even have hinted at the part, you know, if you will, universal Father. But to bring in the fact that all those parts, including the infinite first person, is subordinate to a greater wholeness. You know, that is, you know, has not been very universally told. I mean, you know, it's been hinted at it with special individuals, you know, here and there, like Machiavelli to Melchizedek engaging some of the more brilliant Kenites and things like that. Got a little, you know, but in terms of just basic dispensational revelation, you know, remember it starts out local system scale and then goes up to constellation scale, and you know, and it's a long ways and down the road until you get to the central universe. You know, and some attempt to really speak to the universal Father directly, you know, as a concept for people. Okay, so anyway, back to the material here. So it's you know, that's what's come to an end, is this very definitive dispensational interventionary phenomenon. Now it's all just going to play out through very circuitous, you know, alternative routes through the evolutionary process, and Adam and Eve are just, you know, two more little dots in that big system of dots, you know, that are being coordinated by the evolutionary process. Okay, what else do they give us here?
Adam knew that he and Eve had failed. The presence of the Melchizedek receivers told him that, though he still knew nothing of their personal status or future fate. He held an all-night conference with some 1,200 loyal followers who pledged themselves to follow their leader. And the next day at noon, these pilgrims went forth from Eden in quest of new homes. Adam had no liking for war, and accordingly elected to leave the first garden to the Noddites unopposed.
Okay. In a very fundamental way, why does Adam have no liking for war? Is it because, well, he's just one of those, you know, creatures that's, you know, has tendencies towards pacifism? You know, is that, no, why, right? I mean, you know, it's not some ideological thing or something. And why does he have no liking for war? Why do we have a liking for war? You know, flip it around. It's an animal origin innate thing. I mean, war is natural, is innate in our animal origin nature. Does a material son or daughter have an animal origin nature? No. Right? It's just, you know, so it has nothing to do with some, you know, idealistic, you know, inclinations or something. It's just innate. It's not animal origin. Right? So war is not, you know, a natural mode of consciousness for a material son or daughter.
Yeah. Well, I can't help but think there's a practical reason too.
Well, yeah.
You know, the garden, while the way they set it up could easily be defended, but now they have everybody mad at them, and their numbers were,
yeah,
they had no place to draw more numbers from, so yeah, they would have been.
Yeah. Yeah, we know they were very aggressive in setting up a defense, you know, but, you know, obviously they're not an offensive phenomenon, and, you know, they were never going to be. Right, so there's all those reasons why, okay, and that works out very well that he isn't naturally warlike. I mean, yeah, you can go on, but I just wanted to make sure you recognize that core fact, right? So that... you know, it takes you back to reminding you that war is natural for us, for evolutionary mortals.
So then leave the next day without packing or anything? Like, I guess they didn't have anything to
do. You throw a couple things on a camel and off you go.
and right? At noon.
Yes, and it's always at the auspicious noon, yes.
But many of us have no liking for war either.
Yeah.
Even though,
yeah,
we're animal nature.
Right, I mean, and... right, and with us, it's a combination of nature and nurture. Right?
And choice.
Choice is sort of the highest level of nurture, if you will. But... But, you know, it's, but I just wanted to, you know, make sure you recognize it wasn't just some choice thing, you know, or it wasn't just the way he was taught and conditioned, you know, the way, so his nurture on Gerasim for, you know, tens of thousands of years or whatever. It's just, you know, he doesn't have an animal origin nature. Yeah, so just appreciate that foundational element of it. Big meeting, 1,200 people gathered together. So, but obviously, it's not going to be the everyone in associated with the garden is going to, you know, head east. There's a core group that's going to head east. And this whole bit, you might be kind of confused. Like, well, remember how we were speculating that probably the reason that he came back from the 30 days is when he recognized that the adjuster came. And, you know, and so when they say he still knew nothing of their personal status or future fate, it's like, well, okay, they just said that he knows he failed the Melchizedek receivers, to, you know, being there. You know, it's like, what do they mean by that? You'll see when we get to the beginning of the next section. They'll clean up that loose end of what they mean specifically by personal status or future fate there. Okay.
The Edenic caravan was halted on the third day out from the garden by the arrival of the seraphic transports from Gerasim. And for the first time, Adam and Eve were informed of what was to become of their children. While the transports stood by, those children who had arrived at the age of choice, 20 years, were given the option of remaining on Urantia with their parents or of becoming wards of the Most Highs of Norlaishadek. Two-thirds chose to go to Edentia. About one-third elected to remain with their parents. All children of pre-choice age were taken to Edentia. No one could have beheld the sorrowful parting of this material son and daughter and their children without realizing that the way of the transgressor is hard. These offspring of Adam and Eve are now on Edentia. We do not know what disposition is to be made of them.
So, I was hinting at Proverbs. I think everyone recognizes what's from the book of Proverbs there, don't you? And the way of the transgressor is hard. Now, when they say, right when they start out, informed of what was to become of their children... Okay, here we mean in the general sense. We don't just mean, you know, the first generation. They're direct children. We mean all 1,647. Remember back there, you know, when they told us that when Adam and Eve left the garden, their family consisted of four generations numbering 1,647 pure line descendants. Okay, all that whole 1,647 is in play here. You know that, if nothing else, when you read forward Adamson and Rada, you know, you find that everyone is in play, not just the first generation. But it is. All 1,647. And you've got that very, so you've got that specific, and then... you know, you've got that classic thing about the age of choice, you know, that we so often refer to. This is where they specifically point that out. And then, obviously, if you know, from this, again, with the children, you know, with the violet race, with Adamites, such things as the age of choice, the age of wisdom, and whatnot, those are going to be very precisely expressed. You know, it might not be quite as precisely expressed with humans.
Is it 16 but, for humans?
No.
Is that a different age?
That's the age, and that would be the same for the Damic children. 16 is when there's mindal separation, you know, when the child's, the mindal self of the child is occupying a separate domain in the mind energy system instead of being, you know, overlapping, if you will, with the biologic parents. But just to remind yourself, you know, way back, you may recall way, way, way back when we came upon them talking about these children and how they end up on Edentia. And we talked about, you know, you got to think about the fact that, you know, you've got, you would have had, I mean, first generation children of Adam and Eve under 16, you know, very likely, right? So, I mean, you had, you know, you had some very young first generation children. I mean, they're literally still mindily attached to Adam and Eve. And, you know, this is a very profound situation here. Okay, but if you do, you know, if you just do the math a little bit there, you'll see that when all is said and done, you have approximately 400 pure line that stay, and all the rest go. You know, somewhere right in the neighborhood of 400 stay. You know, remember, and I was alluding to it. If you, when you get up to Adamson Rod, it tells you directly there. Adamson's wife and all of their children left. You know, and all, obviously all of their children weren't under 20 and had to leave. Right? His wife and all of those children. See, so those are second generation. And there's probably, right, some third generation, you know, grandchildren and whatnot there too. I mean, they all left. Adamson and everyone immediately descended from him left. And he was left all alone. Because he felt a duty to mom and dad. It's like, this is really yicky, but I've got to stay. But you can imagine how dramatic that was. You know, for, you know, set aside Adam and Eve, like they're saying, the way of the transgressor is hard. I mean, Adamson didn't transgress. Right? Right, and all of his children, old and young, the little babies, all of them, he watched them all, you know, dematerialized and then seraphimed and all carted off. Very harsh. You know, and just that, you know, that harshness of, yeah, well, I'm 19 and 5/8. Doesn't matter. You have no choice. You're going. You know, so it's a very definitive judgment that's being imposed upon here. You know, shades of absolute law. See, kind of, you know, you're seeing a lot of grace melt away, and this some very sharp, precise application of law is being applied here. And the only thing that skirts around it is free will. If you're beyond the age of choice. Yep.
David Jones is asking, although seraphic transports is the term used, is there a possibility that actual transport crafts may have been used, lots of children involved here?
The answer is no. I mean, from what you know, like, if I mean, I'll tell you where it is. It's back there in God's paper 55, isn't it? Let's see here. Yeah, and the spheres of light and life. Paper 55, section 7 is where we talked about that before. You know, all of them gave up their material bodies, right? You know, this is the literal dematerialization, right? And when they were rematerialized, none of them were rematerialized as with procreative powers. You know, they're not reproducing beings when they were rematerialized. So yeah, I mean, doesn't matter if, I mean, you know, you even have to wonder, were there some kids in the womb? How is that, you know, I mean, they probably have to be dematerialized separately. I mean, you know, I mean, this is a very complicated thing.
That's interesting.
So, you know, there was probably, I mean, you got a lot, 1647, you know, it's bound to be someone who's pregnant.
Buns in the oven.
I mean, so, you know, so think about, you know, how many transport craft are here. Okay. You know, there would have been more than, you know, they use, because, you know, they have no idea how many are going to choose to stay. And, of course, obviously this was all sent well in advance, just like the Melchizedek's. I mean, they've, yeah, you know, probably took them 5 years, all those transport seraphim, to get here. See, and, So it's not like, you know, they're watching them leave and it's like, okay, let's launch out from Gerizim, you know, and we'll get them 3 days out. It's just like, no, I mean, they've been traveling for years and show up 3 days out from them leaving the garden. Yeah, so anyway, yeah, back there, you know, if you can go back and look at those details they give you there about the children on Edentia. Yeah, and I don't want to go way off on that tangent. You know, we talked about it extensively back there. You know, there's this whole issue of exactly in what mode they rematerialized them. That there's, you know, like we talked about with our Adam and Eve. I mean, you know, they don't rematerialize them exactly like they left on Gerizim. They rematerialize them, you know, attuned to the purposes at hand, like attuned to the creatures of this world, so we talked a lot about them being downstepped, but just remember, I mean, you don't have to just think in terms of downstepped. I mean, they can be rematerialized in different modes. So you have that whole speculation potential, exactly in what way were they rematerialized.
Refresh my memory. Yeah. Do material sons and daughters normally live on the headquarters of the constellation? No.
Right? Yeah, right. I mean, so remember, there's that very exceptional thing of, you know, the Most Highs are still in charge of a lot of stuff. And, I mean, some of that that they're in charge of, they hold very close to their vest, obviously. You know, I mean, it's like, no, you're going to be right, you know, in my backyard. You know, and they've been there for all this time, right? And remember, no one knows, none of the authors know what's going to become of them. Adam and Eve, you know, in very short order, you know, knew they were going to live out their life, and you know they had adjusters, and they died, and were repersonalized in the first mansion world, and now and ended up in the 420 counselors, but their children, you know, are all still just sitting there, you know, twiddling their thumbs, waiting for whatever is, you know, going to become of them.
Well, wouldn't at least a number of these people who were transported off have had adjusters?
Right, and so you got that variation. I mean, some of them would have adjusters, some of them wouldn't have had adjusters yet. Right, all those variations are in play. Yeah, I mean, and they don't explain, see, any of those details. It's just, you know, you're just left to speculate about, you know, is there some different, were they handled differently, you know, when they were repersonalized? You know, you have no idea.
But here again, it's all part of the plan.
Right. Whatever was done, it will be seen to be the best thing that, you know, could have been done when all is said and done. We know that much, but the details are not explained.
It's humbling to know the mathematics. Precision by which they timed this journey.
I was gonna ask about that. So at some point, let's say Eve had kind of gotten up to the doorstep and then like, whoa, yeah, I'm not gonna do this. Like, so then you'd have Melchizedek showing up and the seraphic transport just running around going home. I mean,
the transports would have been turned around, I suppose.
In mid-flight.
Yeah, in mid-flight.
So where's the line? Like, I
mean, you want me to try to explain the unexplainable?
Well, I mean, I don't know where actually Eve steps over the line to default. You know, I mean, at what point could she have turned back at the last second?
Well, again, you know, it was done.
Right.
You know, I mean, it wasn't any thinking. You know, it's an act.
So it stops a heavy petting.
No, it's yeah. I mean, it stops at conception.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, it's not. It's, you know, it would have literally been, you know, what if they'd had sex and, you know, and she hadn't gotten pregnant?
And we talked about that.
Right. That's different. Right. But the moment that there's going to be a child, right? Yeah. The moment of conception. And it's not at the moment of birth or anything like that. I see, again, it's, you know, there's you have to think about it existentially, basically, right? The moment there exists a fact that's not part of the plan.
It would have stopped if she made a different choice.
Now, obviously, she's extremely fertile, right? So it's very unlikely, I'm sure, that you could have sex with her and that she wouldn't get pregnant. But
it seems like they had control over birth control somehow.
Oh yeah,
they were
going to
get pregnant.
Sure, right. I mean, they have advanced scientific knowledge. Right. I mean, they could have come, set up shop and genetically re-engineered all of us, immediately. I mean, they have advanced scientific knowledge. Contraception is not an issue. It's the same way with the prince's staff, right? Obviously, they're all over the contraception thing. I mean, they're having sex left and right, and no one's getting pregnant, for hundreds of thousands of years. Okay. Right, I mean, those scientific issues are, trivial for them.
They did have a few midwares, though.
Yes, right. Yeah, there were things that contraception can't block that did happen. Yes. Anyway, so that's I think we had everything there, don't we? Let's see. Other than you can. About 400, remained. So you had about 1,200 out of those 1,647 that were at the age of choice or older. They had a lot of them that were older. A lot of them, see, that could have stayed, didn't. So it was very, very, it's hard enough, all the ones that have no choice, but like I was saying, the poignant example of that is Adamson, right? All of those, in his family, immediate family, that were beyond the age of choice, and not a one of them.
Yeah.
Say, I'll stay with you, Dad.
Yeah, no.
Not a one.
Love you, Dad, but
not that much. I'll be seeing you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're catching up the road.
I was okay to live in the first garden, but something wherever the heck you guys are going, I don't think so. It's pretty harsh. I'm not going to live in some makeshift shack that you guys are going to set up.
Where are we supposed to go?
All right. Nope.
Winston would like to know, did the children remain frozen in the age of their immediate growth departure for Adinsha, even today?
No, I mean, we talked about that way back then. I mean, they're repersonalized and they're alive as material beings. And, this whole bit of, it's like with material sons and daughters on Gerasim. Right, I mean, obviously they're born a babe, and they mature, they plateau, at some level of biologic maturity, and they just stay that way forever. Right, they don't age, quote unquote, past some optimum, level that they mature up to, and then plateau and just stay unchanged for, hundreds of millions of years after that, right? Billions, trillions of years, after that.
Stationary.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see, anything else there? The one little thing between the lines. Think of the logistics of this. Okay. I mean, they just, dematerialize. Okay, no, that takes all kinds of scientific equipment and stuff. I mean, this is vast. Remember, they talk about how much technology is involved.
Yeah.
And how long would this have taken? I mean, Adam and Eve and those that stay, they head on west. I mean, but some, facility has been built here that, who knows how long it took them to go through this whole process of dematerializing all those all his children and getting them in seraphimed and launched, and I mean, it would have taken quite a long time. You know, not to mention, how does this work with all of this technology? I mean, you can't in seraphim that stuff and cart it here. Yeah. So I guess they have to build all this stuff here. Yeah. Now you probably have a master physical controller just think it, right? And at the ultimatonic level, they can assemble machinery, I suppose. but I mean, this is
couldn't have taken too long because the bad guys were after them.
Well, again, I mean,
I
mean, when you have the master physical controllers, you know, at your aid, I mean, no one is going to be. I mean, you know, plus, as near as we can tell, the Noddites didn't follow them, you know, east. You know, they headed down to the garden, found it empty, and you know, and just shrugged, and yeah. But obviously, you know, he's like, well, what about nomads and, you know, and raiders or whatnot? Well, again, you know, when you have master physical controllers, you know, there's nothing they can't protect you from. So, including putting some sort of dome over the whole area that makes it invisible and impenetrable or, you know, I mean, anything you can imagine, right? So, yeah. But definitely not one iota of magic. You know, that's what I'm just trying to stress. Yeah. Right? This all has to be literally done with technology and advanced technology. It's a huge logistic project.
Of little comfort to these guys.
All right, let's keep going here.
It was a sad, sad caravan that prepared to journey on. Could anything have been more tragic? To have come to a world in such high hopes, to have been so auspiciously received, and then to go forth in disgrace from Eden, only to lose more than 3/4 of their children, even before finding a new abiding place.
And that the rest of the mathematics that you needed, the hints for the mathematics are there. Yeah, it's more than 3/4. So. Like I said, it's about 400. See, are left. I see 2 exclamation points in that paragraph. Yeah. So we use exclamation points. We quote proverbs. And again. You know, remember we touched upon this. What a joyous event it was when Adam and Eve left Gerizim with all their kids that are still there. You know, I mean, in very short order. They know all the details. You know, not to mention they would have seen everything being prepared there. It's like, something's happened with mom and dad. right, this vast. Complicated, you know, thing is being set up and is heading off. All right. So, you know, just think about how terrible it is for all of those children, too, at this time.
Huge ripple effect.
Yeah. Like they're saying, I mean, such high hopes, both here and on Gerizim. And not to mention the auspiciously received, not to mention all the humans that are having to deal with this. The regular mortals, I should say, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So before we go on here, just notice in the title, I've stressed this occasionally when it was important, when they use that word, degradation or degeneration and words like that. Okay, vertical. Oh. Right. Adam and Eve are going to be moving down in nature here.
Right,
downgraded is this degradation. So the fact that there's vertical, a very definitive vertical issue in play, that's being stressed in the title there. Okay.
Section 7, Degradation of Adam and Eve. It was while the Edenic caravan was halted that Adam and Eve were informed of the nature of their transgressions and advised concerning their fate. Gabriel appeared to pronounce judgment, and this was the verdict. The planetary Adam and Eve of Urantia are adjudged in default. They have violated the covenant of their trusteeship as the rulers of this inhabited world.
Okay, and there's a little bit more to this too, but you can see this is where they're tying up that loose end, like I was telling you about some more of the details of exactly how they're being judged. But isn't that interesting? Gabriel, okay, it's not only the transport terminal. I mean, Gabriel has made the trip from somewhere too.
He probably moves faster.
Yeah, he probably moves fast. You know, we've often talked about that. We have no idea how fast he can move, and that he's most likely, you know, see, he can move himself. You know, he doesn't have to be transported. But still.
What a shudder that is.
You know, he's got to drop everything. You know, he's got endless important things he's doing all over the local universe. He's got to drop everything.
Like, wow, Gabriel's going down
there. Come here. You know, but, you know, Adam and Eve, you can imagine how they're staring at their shoes here. humbling moment. Yes, Gabriel himself is reading you the Riot Act. dear me. yeah. You just, you know, where's the paper bag? You know, I mean, you know, you can just imagine how much they wanted to crawl in a hole and hide at this point. All because his bronze pecs were glistening in the moonlight, right? Oh, man.
Am I sexy now?
Yes. Okay.
While downcast by the sense of guilt, Adam and Eve were greatly cheered by the announcement that their judges on Salvington had absolved them from all charges of standing in contempt of the universe government. They had not been held guilty of rebellion.
And we'll get to this a little bit more specific, but yeah, we've talked about it before. Remember, the key thing is there's evil, but not sin. It's not deliberate disloyalty to deity.
Yeah.
Okay. So. And see, I was stressing the whole staring at their shoes thing. See, they were greatly cheered. It's like, you know, but then they okay. Yeah. stood up a little straighter, and it's like, well, okay. Keep this all in perspective. Gabriel could have come and, you know, come with a conciliating commission and a divine executioner. Yeah. Could have been worse.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. They would have recognized that.
Pretty quick. Yeah. Okay, so all right, so they're trying to keep objective about it here.
I hope they're getting a kick out of you. I'll tell you in the future.
Yeah. I will stand before the 420 counselors at some point, and, you know, I'd have to. All right.
The Edenic pair were informed that they had degraded themselves to the status of the mortals of the realm, that they must henceforth conduct themselves as man and woman of Urantia, looking to the future of the world races for their future.
So there's the future part more specifically, right? You can imagine there's probably a zillion different, you know, possibilities that could be in play, you know, but it's going to be very straightforward here. I mean, nothing special at all. They're mortal now, and so you're just like any other mortal, right? I mean, you have an adjuster, so you have a soul, you know, which means you can be resurrected on the first mansion world, you know, you keep your nose clean, eventually you get to the core of the finality, right?
You go through birth to through again, so starting out?
No, I mean, you go to, you know, you're repersonalized on the first mansion world, just like you will be.
No, I mean, as a more, oh, they were, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had one big difference.
What?
They had one big difference than we do.
And that's...
Well, they'd already been to Jerusalem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What was coming.
Yeah, but they hadn't been there as a mortal. Yeah.
But they had a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
You know, they had a
sure. good idea. Sure. Yeah, and, you know, like we talked about way back there, obviously they would have made it through, especially the first mansion worlds, in very, very short order, right? I mean, but still, you know, they would have done the bare minimum anyway on the seven mansion worlds and become a Gerasim citizen again, right? They had to be reestablished as a Gerasim citizen. They weren't a card carrying Gerasim citizen once they defaulted. So it's just. Right. I mean, you know, and remember when you talk about the finaliters, some of the finaliters are one-time material sons and daughters. You know, and they, you know, it's not just through this avenue, but there's a lot of different avenues that they can end up there.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, but I'm sure in terms of the material sons and daughters, right, it's going to be a fairly small club amongst the finaliters of,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was a one-time Adam and Eve and defaulted. Right.
He's got a special place for
you. Yep.
John Stevens is asking if you would comment on the word contempt, as in contempt of universe government.
Oh, they're using that very strong word, to hint at the specifics that I was bringing up, that there wasn't that, fully conscious rejection. They'll speak to it, like I said, in a little bit more, and we get towards the end of the section here. But the point is, it's the word contempt. The strength of that word is meant to suggest sin, in contrast to just mere evil. Yeah. There isn't anything literally etymologically to the word, that distinguishes it, as sin from evil. But that words, that are in the thesaurus with contempt. I mean, contempt is a pretty strong word. All right. Let's see. Make sure we've got everything here. Yeah. Okay. This is that basic fact about that they're going to just be in the normal mode. Obviously, remember they're going to live a long time because their genetics is quite exceptional. So. So there is that little difference about their mortality. They're not going to, it's not going to be 70 years and 10, or by reason of strength 80, right? I mean, it's going to be hundreds of years that they're going to live. But, but still, other than that, it's just all going to play out. They're not going to do anything special. That obviously you could speculate endlessly about the special things that could have been done. Gabriel could have said, and we're going to have this special difference, and I'm sure there's more things that we can't think of than we can think of that are done sometimes in these sorts of cases. But anyway, it's all just going to play out very, quote unquote, naturally, if you will.
Yeah.
All right.
Long before Adam and Eve left Gerasim, their instructors had fully explained to them the consequences of any vital departure from the divine plans. I had personally and repeatedly warned them, both before and after they arrived on Urantia, that reduction to the status of mortal flesh would be the certain result, the sure penalty, which would unfailingly attend default in the execution of their planetary mission. But a comprehension of the immortality status of the material order of sonship is essential to a clear understanding of the consequences attendant upon the default of Adam and Eve.
Okay, so they're going to remind us of the physics here as we read these next two paragraphs. But just notice the selection of words by Salonia. She speaks in first person there to boot. vital departure, right? You know, it's not any departure, right? And boom, you're in default. Right. And we were kind of hinting at that, right? But it has to be a vital departure. It has to, you know, there has to be a phenomenon. And the material sons and daughters, like they tell you, are innately, finely attuned to be a meter, a measuring device of vital departure. And it's just like, it's like this distinction is vital, right? That I quote all the time. That kind of the inherent living synchronization with the cosmic system, that kind of vital. Yeah, again, but there's some physics to this, right? There's some departure that's not vital, okay, and then there's some line you cross. I mean, and who knows where this is.
They have to have some wiggle room.
Right, right. I mean, there has to be wiggle room for free will. Yeah. Right? I mean, they have their free will sovereigns of the world. Right?
It wasn't micromanaged.
It's not like you could replace them with automatons. Okay? That's not the way they come to a world. So, they have all kinds of, liberty, but there's some boundary line, and you cannot cross it. Okay, and it has to do, see, somehow with, you cross that line, and you've just presumed upon the whole. Right? That's, you've overplayed your part as a part.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, what's this first issue?
One, Adam and Eve, like their fellows on Gerizim, maintained a moral status through intellectual association with the mind-gravity circuit of the spirit. When this vital sustenance is broken by mental disjunction, then, regardless of the spiritual level of creature existence, immortality status is lost. Mortal status, followed by physical dissolution, was the inevitable consequence of the intellectual default of Adam and Eve.
Jesus. It's not a spiritual issue. Right? It's a mindal issue. The intellectual default of Adam. You know, reminding us again. So even though they've been, when they were rematerialized, they were downstepped, it doesn't mean that they don't still have that top-level nature that a material son and daughter has innately on Gerizim, where they are synchronized with the mind of the cosmos, if you will, and have this very, like I was saying, there's this very delicate balance to that, and this the slightest holistic breaking of that, and they come unplugged from that highest aspect of their nature. Okay. But they're about to, you go, well, what about the tree of life and all that? Okay, well, that's coming up in item number two. It's not just that, because they're reminding you that, setting aside the technicality of the tree of life and all that, the additional circulatory system and all the stuff they're about to tell us about, it's still the case that they have this mind issue, right? That effectively, that makes them mortal. Right, and then you just have to keep in mind the additional technical-ish details with the fruit of the tree of life. Okay, so what do they say about that?
Two, the material son and daughter of Urantia, being also personalized in the similitude of the mortal flesh of this world, were further dependent on the maintenance of a dual circulatory system, the one derived from their physical natures, the other from the super energy stored in the fruit of the tree of life. Always had the archangel custodian admonished Adam and Eve that default of trust would culminate in degradation of status, and access to this source of energy was denied them subsequent to their default.
Okay, a bunch of details there, but the first thing I'll just, the loose end. Remember last week, Gene, you asked me, is there some other place in the book that they talk about the archangel custodian? You know, and when you asked me, it's like, I wasn't sure. It's like, I think there is. I think I remember it somewhere else. Well, here it is. It's just, you know, yeah. So it's just immediate, in this immediate context that they say it again. You know, it isn't like way back there in paper 55 or something like that, or some other place. But I thought I had a vague memory that of coming upon it somewhere else, but it's just right away, immediately here. So again, we don't know the details there. They are, you know, well, when is there an archangel custodian? Was there an archangel custodian before Adam and Eve arrived? You know, all those questions we were asking, we don't know the details. But okay, but anyway, the whole bit, okay, so you notice how they said it in a way that I always basically say it. They haven't really said it before. See, they were also personalized in the similitude of the mortal flesh of this world. And I always talk about, see, they're downstepped and specifically attuned to the biology of this world. Okay. In this case, they weren't attuned so that they should be directly mating, but they were attuned to sort of, you know, just a little bit higher than the level of directly mating. But we know in some worlds they actually do directly mate. That's normal. So, you know, this attunement and this downstepping would be slightly different, perhaps. Not to mention all of the things of all the different types of mortals, like, you know, really extreme when you go to non-breathers. Right, you have this very different similitude of the mortal flesh on a non-breather world. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, they enumerate these one and two, so they're separate issues.
Yeah.
The mortal issue and the tree of life issue. So I get the sense that if they had been able to continue to partake of the tree of life, it would have prolonged their life.
Okay, I was about.
Even though their status is now mortal.
Right, I was gonna get to that. I mean that's the key point. Why are they making a point of separating these two issues so precisely, which they haven't done before?
Right.
Okay, so the first one is okay. Like I said, technically they're mortal because of that first one. Just like they were still on Gerasim and hadn't become an Adam and Eve. If they had disrupted their mind, they would have become mortal. So you go, well, then what's the deal with the fruit of the tree of life? I mean, they could eat it, but it's not going to make them immortal like it was, you know, involved in making that happen before. So why would they be denied access to the tree of life? Like they say, see, it wasn't that they couldn't benefit from it. They were denied. Okay. The first thing that one might speculate about is, well, what about the leaves? Probably the leaves don't do anything by themselves. We kind of talked about this before. But, you know, when the fruit, you know, does what it does, then the leaves also can do something. But then you go, well, what about the healing of the nations thing with the leaves? I mean, there's some mysteries to this. But you're left kind of groping about with the physics because they're obviously not allowed to give you anything too definitive here. You know, there's also the possibility that you brought up. It's like, well, maybe the main thing is not something to do with the leaves, which is also needing the fruit in some way. If they ate the fruit, they would live longer. But you know, it kind of sounds from the first one that, see, when this vital sustenance is broken by mental disjunction, it's like, well, did they come completely unplugged? So that they wouldn't, remember, it's not just ingesting the fruit. You know, the master physical controllers are feeding energy into them. So you're left a little bit confused here. It's like, well, is there just one type of energy? Do we have some different types? And the mental disjunction is severing them from something some higher energy, and but the fruit would still keep them plugged into some lower energy. I'm not sure. There's no way to know. They don't give you any material. But the very fact that they had to deny them tells you there's something. Okay, it still it would do something.
Yeah. We call it a source of energy.
Right. It obviously wouldn't have made them immortal to eat the fruit. Okay, but...
it's different than the Caligastia 100.
Yeah, see, and they're different. See, because the Caligastia 100 don't have that mind attunement thing like a material son and daughter do. All right, so that it all is very much just with the tree. See, like I said, they're giving you clues, but I'm not sure how much the clues help us here. It kind of leads to more questions than answers, I think, in a lot of ways here. But they are kind of reminding you of that within Adam and Eve, when it's an issue of, it's one thing when you're being maintained immortal, the role of the tree. But going to mortal status, the tree's not the primary issue. Their mind is the primary issue. Okay, maintaining their immortality. Okay, the tree is the major issue. But now you've got this other issue of the mind. It's not just the tree. That's what they're trying to point out. When you go there, it's one thing to maintain. It's another thing what happens when they go down.
The Caligastia 100 were ascendant mortals. I mean, they lived a mortal existence.
Yeah, right. There's all that whole issue that they were one time mortals and all that. And there's lots and lots of physics questions here that we can't answer. But all we can do here is we're noting, they're wanting to remind us that the key issue is their mind nature, not so much the tree. Okay. Which is what you might initially, be fixated on, even as a Urantia book reader, because of the prince's staff. Okay, there's kind of a bigger issue in play with them. That mysterious physics that they're hinting at with the mind gravity circuits and the mental disjunction and all that, whatever that means specifically. All right, so there you have it. You wonder exactly how this works. They were denied. Did they have the thought? Well, we definitely want to grab the core of the tree and haul it with us. And they went to try to do that. Was it blocked?
It was custodian. He said, "Hey, you can't."
Custodian,
you can't.
They could have said, we're not subject to your dictates anymore, Archangel, right? We're going to take the tree anyway. I mean, Archangel can't stop them. I mean, Archangel has a very difficult time having much of a relationship to matter at all. Okay, but master physical controllers or primary, midwayers, I mean, we don't know. I mean, in some way, they were probably literally denied. There was some sort of a physical way that they were prevented from having access. In the same way we saw with the rebellion, I mean, the primary midwayers, took possession of the tree and, right. So, again, they just don't give us any details, again, about how we're supposed to interpret those vague statements. But anyway... you at least know that they could have gained something from having access to the tree. But like I said, this is going to be very natural, the way their life plays out. As natural as it can be is the way it's going to play out. And no additional things. Maybe on some other world there's a default and they are continued to have access to the tree, maybe. You could speculate, see? But not this world anyway. Yep.
Stevens is wondering if Adam and Eve had three different systems.
No, I mean, see, it's with the prince's staff, it's different. With the prince's staff, they had a whole Morantia energy system. And material sons and daughters don't have that. I mean, you know, they don't have even a soul, right, until they get an adjuster. Right? There's nothing Morantia at all about them, you know, naturally. You know, at this point, we're pretty certain that they've gotten an adjuster, and so Adam and Eve have souls now. But they don't have an entire Morantia body like the prince's staff had, you know, when they were on Gerasim, and that was carted over here and synchronized with a material body, you know, all that mystery. In that sense, the material son and daughters in Adam and Eve are a simpler fact, simpler construct. Okay.
What they're getting at isn't about physical access to the tree, but just that they can just no longer access the energy is just not available. Regardless of the tree, or
like I said, you can speculate. When you look at it, it's hard to figure out if you can pin anything down. Yeah.
The mindal thing is just a physics.
Uh-huh.
The thing with the tree of life, that's the consequence of judicial action. Defaulted, therefore. You know, that's being imposed upon.
Right.
By a higher authority.
Yeah, right, and that's what I was trying to stress. I mean, you at least know that much. Like I tried to say, when all is said and done, the physics is vague, but, you know that there's two elements to it. One just happens naturally to themselves when they default, and the other is being imposed upon them. Yeah. Okay.
Caligastia did succeed in trapping Adam and Eve, but he did not accomplish his purpose of leading them into open rebellion against the universe government. What they had done was indeed evil, but they were never guilty of contempt for truth. Neither did they knowingly enlist in rebellion against the righteous rule of the Universal Father and his Creator Son.
Okay, so there you see the contempt word again, see? And you very much see it in contrast, being used in contrast to evil. Right? They had done, what they had done was indeed evil. You know, and then you go, but it wasn't sin. But they don't say that directly. They give you a little different twist on that. Right? They were never guilty of contempt for truth. They definitely have issues of relationship to the whole, the truth, but not willfully. There is that non-purposeful disruption that is evil, but not sin.
And they weren't trapped. It's not a small thing that somebody like Caligastia trapped them.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck anyone facing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we all know that, even Jesus as a first circler knew he should ask permission. It's like, can I, be allowed to take on Satan and Caligastia face to face. He knows full well how clever they are. Those Lenonidex are silver-tongued, right? And very fancy. And you shouldn't think, I'd stand unmoved in the face. No, you wouldn't. They'd have you wrapped around their fingers so fast. You couldn't tell yourself definitively enough, no, this is an evil person, this is an evil person. You just immediately be drawn into them, right?
Wet clay.
Right. So the fact that Adam and Eve were, they were doing a great conscious job of saying no to Caligasha and all these machinations. But he got them under the radar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I don't really get. I've never gotten what Caligasha or any of them get out of derailing Adam and Eve or anything else. The whole doctrine of liberty. I mean, that's everybody should just be able to do what they want. Well, shouldn't Adam and Eve be free to follow the divine way according to that doctrine, right?
Yeah, but remember, there's no longer that objective perspective going on in their minds. You know, what's happening? They've gone from righteousness to self-righteousness, and then there's projection, right? I mean, no one that's self-righteous thinks they're self-righteous. They think they're righteous. Right? Their self-righteousness is projected outward. That is righteousness to them. I mean, of course they want everyone to join in the righteousness.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not consistent. It's like you're saying, it's like, well, no. I thought the whole bit about liberty, you know, everyone can do it their own way. They say that, but it's not what they're really doing. Because of this projection. They're really trying to impose themselves on everyone else in the name of righteousness. Yeah.
And they didn't have any true benevolence. I mean, nefarious is nefarious.
Yeah.
The orgy of darkness and death is not benevolent. Like they don't have a benevolent bone in their body, mind, whatever.
And think again, I mean, this is entirely right. I mean, this is what people all around you are doing all the time.
Yeah, read the paper.
Right? I mean, you know, why do all these people that are all animated want others to join with them?
Yeah.
And is it because they're thinking, I want you to put yourself subservient to me, you know, the great and glorious one? No. It's like they want everyone to join the righteousness that they've discovered. So they think. That's what drives people. It's just, you know, you've lost all objectivity, and so you project outward and become the definition of objectivity.
The higher authority.
Right. Yeah. Right. You know, and you don't, and eventually, so you don't even, you're cosmically insane. You have no clue that that's what you're doing. It appears to you that the cosmos speaks thus. And it's so wonderful because it's nothing but affirmation, the voice of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
See? You know, they don't see themselves as projecting and imposing themselves on others. They see themselves existing in this wonderful, affirming sphere of wholeness, and everyone should join them, right, in this wonderful space. And that's what's going on. All right. Let's see. All right, so that, you know, that contempt for truth, again, that wholeness, remember I stressing that about the word truth. And you notice that that's the main thing they say, and then they throw parenthetically, neither did they knowingly enlist in rebellion against the righteous rule of the Universal Father and the Creator Son. I mean, the key thing is not some part-wise issue like we would think, right? That issue. The key is the whole. That's fundamentally the issue. And how you rationalize with the parts is secondary. It's like the first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. If you try to interpret that fundamentally in a part-wise fashion, you will think, oh, this is all about, you know, this is like atheistic or something. This is rejecting God. No, the first principle, you know, is fundamentally saying that there is no purposeful whole. Right? It's the nihilistic principle. And then whatever part rationalization thing you throw in is secondary. You know, that's what I try to stress when you interpret those three principles. Interpret them mother first, father second. Even if they seem to be directly talking about the father, don't be you know, taken off point by that. The fundamental key is, like they're stressing here, you know, you're rejecting that you should be in cooperative subordination to a whole beyond yourself. That's the fundamental issue of default or rebellion. And then how you rationalize the details is, you know, that obviously comes naturally, but it's secondary. Okay.
Section 8, the so-called fall of man. Adam and Eve did fall from their high estate of material sonship down to the lowly status of mortal man. But that was not the fall of man. The human race has been uplifted despite the immediate consequences of the Adamic default. Although the divine plan of giving the violet race to the Urantia peoples miscarried, the mortal races have profited enormously from the limited contribution which Adam and his descendants made to the Urantia races.
See, and they start out speaking to this so-called fall of man by turning everything on its head. Right? I mean, yes, like I pointed out with the title of the preceding section, they went down, they quote-unquote fell. Right? There is a vertical issue, downward vertical issue with the two of them, but everyone else went up. Right, the worst that could have happened is that they would have had no biologic impact, and man would have stayed stationary vertically. Right, but you know, even if every child had left, and it was just the two of them, right? They had two children. Yeah. And that would have been an uplift of mankind. It would have been much tinier than, you know, but that would have been an uplift.
They got to do their small plan.
And, you know, everyone knows may be only 400 to start with. Well, it was only 2 to start with Anna and Infanta. Yeah. 400 is not, you know, insignificant. Family trees branch rapidly, right? So, you know, like they're pointing out, you know, you have to think objectively about this. You know, we always think negatively about the default. It's like fixating on the crucifixion instead of the resurrection. Right? You know, humans figure that out. It's like, let's take Jesus off the cross. We'll keep the cross as our symbol, but let's take the crucified Christ off of it, right? And have an empty cross to remind us of, right, of the resurrection instead of the death. Okay? I mean, that's what they're trying to do here. You know, that little bit goes a long way. Those 400, you know, roughly 400 individuals had a very, very significant impact. It's all relative. If everything had gone on his plan, it would have been, you know, many orders of magnitude greater uplift, but it's still a very definitive uplift. You know, just look at the way they speak of it there. Profited enormously. Okay? They're using pretty grand words. So, let's see, anything else there? Notice they said miscarried, right? I mean, yeah, there's all kinds of wrong, but the Supreme Mind can do good with even what's wrong, right? It takes every finite fact and does something positive with it. So it doesn't matter how many times, you know, because there's evil, you know, the MIS prefix you know, can be used in many ways to describe what just happened. You know, there's wrongness, there's evil, but still, when all is said and done, everything is just so. You know, in supremacy, there are no coincidences. So, you know, in this case, because there's this immediate biologic thing, I mean, you don't have to think very abstract way about it. It's just right there, biologic uplift in a very immediate fashion. In short order, you have a whole race of uplifted people. Okay.
There has been no, quote, fall of man. The history of the human race is one of progressive evolution, and the Adamic bestowal left the world peoples greatly improved over their previous biologic condition. The more superior stocks of Urantia now contain inheritance factors derived from as many as 4 separate sources: Andonite, Sangic, Nodite, and Adamic.
And again, see, greatly improved. Now, it's very encouraging just how strong modifiers they use here. You know, we should be left very thankful that they did what they did. I mean, it's like you look around, you say, like, yeah, this world is just hopeless. It's terrible. Think about how hopeless it would have been if we got no Adamic uplift.
Yeah.
Right. The fact that you'd have to reverse these, you know, things like greatly and enormously, you know, to their opposites, you know, in a negative fashion. And it's definitely a mustard seed sort of an impact that they had. A little bit actually goes a long ways. You know, there wouldn't be anything on the planet that you would, you know, from our sense, that you'd want to call civilization without them. I mean, anywhere that there's something that you think, you know, I really have to call this civilization, that's because of the biologic uplift. It's not natural. Okay. You could have some kind of fancy culture, but yeah, calling it, you know, definitively civilization, not so much. Not without Adam and Eve. It would all be very Sangic, place-like, you know, just kind of going nowhere without them, directionizing mankind biologically. Okay.
Adam should not be regarded as the cause of a curse upon the human race. While he did fail in carrying forward the divine plan, while he did transgress his covenant with deity, while he and his mate were most certainly degraded in creature status, notwithstanding all this, their contribution to the human race did much to advance civilization on Urantia.
Again, did much. And they even used the word advance, not just progress.
Yeah.
So you notice, I mean, how they're repeating it, you know, they want to really pound this into us. Stop dwelling on the negative. All in all, it was a huge positive. You know, should not, you know, in other words, yeah, but everyone does, you know, including your Urantia book readers, regard it as a, you know, a cause of a curse on the human race. Like, no, you shouldn't do that. And then, you know, look at how delightful it is. You know, they actually remind you of the new definition of sin.
Yeah.
Right? Sin is not transgression of taboo. It's deliberate disloyalty to deity. And there is no deliberate disloyalty to deity. Yes, there's disloyalty to deity, but not deliberate disloyalty to deity. Yeah, just disloyalty to deity, that's evil. Deliberate is sin. Right, and they even reminded you of the old transgression of taboo by using the word transgress.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, that gets back to that what I was saying a little bit about the whole first, the part second. You know, that's the striking thing about the redefinition of sin. It's not deliberate disloyalty to God. That part-like thought. It's deity. It's to that fact that's transcendent of God. To that fundamental wholeness. That's what sin is about. What evil's about too, right? That's what these should be judged relative to. Not, did you impose microaggressions on the universal father and therefore you're sinful? Right? It's not a part-wise issue like that. And that's a huge thing in the fifth epical revelation, to try to somehow think beyond the parts. Think of the significance of sin is transcendent of the seven absolutes of infinity. It's transcendent of the universal father. That's how extreme it is. So how many people get called sinful, do you think, really are? No. They're transgressing some arbitrary current taboo. Yeah. It has nothing to do with sin. It isn't even remotely evil. It's nothing. It's irrelevant. But, most of the stuff that's called sin.
They offended
some. Right. I guess that's why I purposely threw in the microaggression thing, just right. To, right, use hyperbole to stress it.
It's because of Adam and Eve that we can be people of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And the fall of man, that idea, it says that pre-Adamic man still was evolutionary in his thinking. Mm-hmm. He wasn't really future-oriented, but he didn't think he had fallen down from some high estate.
Right.
Somehow the idea of the fall of man has to sync with the rebellion, that's where the fall of man. Really.
Well, the details of where the concept of fall of man, they don't explain it here. They just point out that it's not the Adam and Eve thing. When we get to the evolution of religion papers later on, they actually build up in an evolutionary sense and explain where that rationalization scheme comes from. But here they're just trying to point out Adam and Eve are not the answer. There is a fall of man rationalization scheme in play, obviously. They wouldn't have a section titled this, but. Not only shouldn't you, now that you know the real Adam and Eve story, think that that explains the fall of man, but the revelators later on say, the actual fall of man is, a more complicated issue than just some triviality of rationalizing relative to Adam and Eve. Yeah. Now, the rebellion in Adam and Eve, they do feed into it, obviously, right? But it's a more complicated issue than it would initially appear. Okay, let's see. All right, so there we have transgress his covenant with deity. So there is disloyalty to deity. Okay, there is evil. Okay, what else do they say here?
In estimating the results of the Adamic mission on your world, justice demands the recognition of the condition of the planet. Adam was confronted with a well-nigh hopeless task when, with his beautiful mate, he was transported from Gerizim to this dark and confused planet. But had they been guided by the Council of the Melchizedeks and their associates, and had they been more patient, they would have eventually met with success. But Eve listened to the insidious propaganda of personal liberty and planetary freedom of action. She was led to experiment with the life plasm of the material order of sonship, and that she allowed this life trust to become prematurely commingled with that of the then mixed order of the original design of the life carriers, which had been previously combined with that of the reproducing beings once attached to the staff of the planetary prince.
That final statement's a mouthful. Yes, but I think you get the point, right? You know who she mated with. Yeah, so again, I mean, it's all very, you know, basically straightforward, but they're just, again, italicized, stressing it yet again. I mean, yeah, okay, the part-wise issue, yeah, it's there, you know, if they had been guided by the council of the Melchizedeks and their associates, but the main issue is not things like that. The main issue is, had they been more patient? That's the main issue. And that will be your main issue too. It's not whether or not you have all kinds of helpers on the first mansion world or don't have helpers here. That's not the main issue. It's whether you have that fundamental prerequisite to begin to establish an integrous synchronization with the cosmos, that foundation of all that cosmic character, patience. Trusting the evolutionary process, trusting the grace that has been given to you, and being patiently present with it, and letting things just unfold. You know, but instead we're looking for ever, you know, more flammable things to pour on our hair and light, right? Run around like chickens with their head cut off, right? You know, the very antithesis of patience is what rules the day these days. With anyone with any spiritual consciousness, the only people that are patient are ones that don't have much in the way of spiritual consciousness. They're just naturally patient. But the second you give anyone on this planet any spiritual consciousness, off on a self-righteous tangent they go. I mean, it shows you how wrong it is to think that spirit is innately divine. In the hands of ignorant children, it's innately destructive, is what it is.
There are some. I mean, there are some exceptions. There are some people that are spiritual conscious, also well aware of patience, and you can see that, and when you do see it, you recognize it right away.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's rare.
It's rare. See, you know, and the, you know, it's always been quite rare. You know, and it's just seen in recent years that spiritual consciousness is not as rare. Those who have a personal over control of it is still rare, like it's always been, and that's the emergency, right? The emergency is not that you have so few that have control of their spiritual consciousness. That's always been the case. Again, the main issue is you have all of this uncontrolled spiritual consciousness. You have a lot of people where the word liberty burns in their mind, and it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to the three principles of the Lucifer Manifesto when you get that word in your head and don't have any cosmic integrity to your mind. It's immediately false liberty. See, again, that true or false, that relationship to the whole. You got this groovy part called liberty, but that part has to be in cooperative subordination to the whole. It has to be true liberty. Otherwise, it's self-destructive and cataclysmic for all those around you. Right? Liberty is not innately a divine thing in your mind. It's just as potentially destructive as constructive. It's up to you which it's going to be. And for those that don't really have the word liberty burning in their mind, okay, that's not an issue. Right? Again, it's not an emergency that there's a lot of very prosaic individuals on the planet. It's the unbridled poets, right, if you will. That's the tricky part. Right? And they keep stressing that in this Adam and Eve story. Right?
Sure, they're the chief promoters of these tenets.
The moment Adam and Eve, with their spiritual consciousness, got out their their poster board and their wooden stick and painted the sign, "What do we want?" That's when it all went off the rails. It's just as simple as that. It's not, you got to be patient. You got to put a bridle on your spiritual consciousness. You have to be humble. Right? It doesn't mean that you don't have a passion for a better world, but you have to know your place, right? You're not sovereign of the external world. And the moment you start thinking you are, see, that's when you're projecting your self-righteousness out. Right? The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men, not any of us. They're sovereign out there, not us. You have to be humble about that. Right? You have to learn to find that you've got to get above that tension between those ideals that start to burn in your mind with your spiritual consciousness and the very prosaic external world that you find yourself in the midst of. Right? You have to get above that tension and manage it, or it'll tear you apart.
The quote was, "Not he who conquers a city,
yeah, right,
you know, masters his tongue."
Right. See, your job is an internal job.
Yeah.
Right. They humans knew that way back in the ancient past. Right.
Yeah.
Right? Like they quoted Proverbs. You know, those things that go, you know, way back before the Hebrews even. Right. Those elements of wisdom that humans figured out way back, predicated on Andites with some better mind, right? And the moment that you lose those basic points of recognition, everything is going to go quite poorly. It all begins with the impatience thing. That's the spark that ignites an emergency.
So let's hurry up.
Yeah. Yep. Why are we taking so long to finish this section? Okay, let's see. Anything else? I think that it's just mainly that. Notice they said well nigh hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we stressed that. It, in other words, even to someone as advanced of mind as Adam and Eve, it appeared to be hopeless. No matter how much they squinted, they couldn't see anything but hopelessness. It's only insight that checks that and says, yes, but it's not really hopeless. No matter how hopeless it seems, it never is. There is no such thing as a state that is really hopeless. Such a state does not exist anywhere in the universe of universes. It's never happened anywhere in your life. It's never happened anywhere on this planet, at any place, at any time. There's never been a really hopeless state of affairs. It can't exist because the Supreme Mind is transcendent of all finite facts. There's things that appear quite hopeless, well nigh hopeless even, right? There's this one nano dot, you know, that would give you a hint that it wasn't hopeless, and there's no way to notice that in the midst of all the blackness. But you have to know it. It can't be really. There is no such thing as a really hopeless situation. And we've stressed this before. Those who are successful fundamentally know that, and that's why they always do things that everyone says are impossible. Yeah, and it's not because they have incredible minds that can see the end from the beginning. No, they can't see the end from the beginning any more than you or I can. But they know that the appearance is not the reality. They know that no matter how much it appears to be hopeless, there is no such thing. There's always a way.
Yeah, there's always a way.
And if you are just patient and keep your eyes open, try to objectively approach the situation, you will come through to the other side. You always will. They know that. nothing can shake that from them. And that's why they're leaders. That's why they succeed where everyone else fails. Right? All the naysayers are those that believe that appearance is reality. Right? And a very small few know otherwise. Yeah, that's the key. Yeah? And so, you can just watch that. You know, look how uncommon it is that someone knows the difference in appearance and reality. All these brilliant people, you know, 5 PhDs from 5 different Ivy League schools, yada, yada, yada. They think appearance is reality, and they're constantly saying such and so is hopeless, or you can't do it that way, you shouldn't do that, on and on and on. You know, they blather. There is no such thing as a really hopeless situation. You know, and a few people that they think are stupid, know otherwise.
Right. And that's interesting because, in a way, they were the hope of the world. And so for them to think it was hopeless. But for us, they came from a whole different existence and they came here and said, oh my God, what am I doing? But for us who come from here, their existence, if we had been there at the time, was our hope. You know, we would have seen it totally opposite of what they saw.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that, and that's probably one of the beauties of being from this world, the lowest world in the universe, that as we progress, everything is so much, better, more hopeful, than it, because we've experienced the worst, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool,
I think. Yeah, you noticed I was, without saying it, I was hinting at the core consciousness of an Agandotter, a real Agandotter, right? Knows that there is no such thing as something that's really hopeless. It's never really dark. There's no reality to darkness. The only thing that's real is light. Light is, darkness is the absence of light. It's no reality to it. Okay? It just appears to be dark, but it's not really. There is no other, negative substance. There is no dark stuff. Right? That's why it's so ridiculous, to start talking about dark energy, as the fundamental stuff. It's just an absolute absurdity.
Right? The smallest something,
definitely
bigger than the largest nothing.
Yeah, that's the potential of being born in a world like this. That potential to know that. You may not figure that out in this life. Just because you are born on this nativity sphere, you aren't magically an Agandotter. You have to come to that Agandotter consciousness in the first mansion worlds. Right? It finally becomes clear to you, right? that it isn't. There is no such thing as real darkness. Even the orgy of darkness and death is just an appearance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not an absolute reality.
They all scatter if you come in out of the flashlight.
But there's something poignant about going through things that are tragic and sad. It is a growth potential.
You imagine it,
and it's kind of a beautiful thing, and yet, you don't want to pretend it's nothing either. It's harsh and hard to go through.
Very harsh parts, but you discover it can awaken you to the greater whole, right? By engaging those very harsh parts, those very troublesome, painful, whatnot parts, you amazingly can discover the whole that transcends them. I see, by grace, you're given that relationship to the whole. And a lot of times it actually takes that contrast or that dark part to finally awaken. It's like, wait a minute, it's just a part. It's not the whole, and there is the whole is light. There's not one iota of darkness in the whole.
But you must engage. Huh? If you don't engage.
You have to engage. You can't hide. World. You can't, you know, your religion can't be escapism. You can't, you know, can't go escape from all the prickly parts. Right, you can't stay in the tent on the mountaintop, on the Mount of Transfiguration, right? Whatever analogy you want or reference you want to use. Yeah. Right. Face facts and adjust them to ideals. Okay, let's keep going.
Never in all your ascent to paradise will you gain anything by impatiently attempting to circumvent the established and divine plan by shortcuts, personal inventions, or other devices for improving on the way of perfection, to perfection, and for eternal perfection.
Right, as I was just stressing, and they stressed in a separate paragraph as a bottom line. Never in all your ascent to paradise will you gain anything by impatiently whatever, right? Right, dot, dot, dot. Right. You know, it's any impatience is a poison to your relationship to the cosmos. Yeah. Spirit poisons are one thing, cosmic poisons are worse. Yeah. You know, we're trying to stress that. Spirit is not the end point here, right? There's the whole. It's one thing to be severed from a part. It's a very bad thing to be severed from the whole. Right.
Consider the part
or both. Yeah, right. Okay, so right, it's just there. I mean, it's just blatantly obvious why they're going on about Adam and Eve, because it's not really about Adam and Eve. It appears to be about Adam and Eve. But as the revelation of truth, it's not about Adam and Eve. That's the disclosure of facts. Right? This story is not really about Adam and Eve. It's about you and me, right? And our relationship to the cosmos. That's the truth that's flowing through this.
Like what we just read, never will your ascend.
Yeah.
We're not talking about Adam and Eve.
Right, right. Yeah. See, the bottom line is not about Adam and Eve. It's about you.
Right. But this makes us fond of Adam and Eve. So it's a relationship.
Yeah.
For us with them.
Yeah, I mean.
Like they're going to tell you they got a kick out of you doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I was doing a little reversion director for them there. You remember when you were staring at your shoes?
Yeah,
I remember that.
Revelation in the weird terms you use, like, the things I used to write down,
trying to get you to engage it in literal fashion and not in some airy fairy mystical way, you know, or that is of utterly no use to you.
It's cool.
All right.
All in all, there probably never was a more disheartening miscarriage of wisdom on any planet in all Nebadon. But it is not surprising that these missteps occur in the affairs of the evolutionary universes. We are a part of a gigantic creation, and it is not strange that everything does not work in perfection. Our universe was not created in perfection. Perfection is our eternal goal, not our origin.
Yeah, you know that. I stress that over and over. How many people with spiritual consciousness think they're living in Havana? Yeah. It's like, dude. I mean, get a clue here. Yes. Our universe was not created in perfection. Right, you know, you've got to separate idea from ideal. And again, notice we have a miscarriage. All right, and there was another one there. Where was the other one? Misstep. Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, like I said, the miss prefix is definitely in play. But see, notice it's a miscarriage of what? Wisdom, see, again. The whole. Okay.
If this were a mechanistic universe, if the first great source and center were only a force and not also a personality, if all creation were a vast aggregation of physical matter dominated by precise laws characterized by unvarying energy actions, then might perfection obtain, even despite the incompleteness of universe status. There would be no disagreement. There would be no friction. But in our evolving universe of relative perfection and imperfection, we rejoice that disagreement and misunderstanding are possible, for thereby is evidenced the fact and act of personality in the universe. And if our creation is an existence dominated by personality, then can you be assured of the possibilities of personality survival, advancement, and achievement? We can be confident of personality growth, experience, and adventure. What a glorious universe, in that it is personal and progressive, not merely mechanical or even passively perfect. Presented by Solonia, the seraphic voice in the garden.
Okay, ends with an exclamation point and a big flourishy paragraph. Okay, so you know, let's look at the elements there. You know, they never miss an opportunity to throw in these little precise things we talk about all the time. Notice the contrast between perfection and completeness. You know, they throw in there about, you know, a third of the way into that paragraph. Right? You ascend to perfection on the Isle of Paradise, but you are woefully incomplete still. Okay? Now, you ascend to perfection and then you penetrate horizontally to completion. Okay, so, you know, they're getting you to reflect on that distinction. It's one thing to perfect a part. It's another thing to completely synchronize that part with the whole. And then, you know, we got the mis prefix again, misunderstanding. And, you know, you hear me bring this up all the time here about, you know, that if you didn't have personality, right, there would be no disagreement. There would be no friction. What do you mean? Personality brings disagreement and friction? I thought it was a gift from the Father.
Absolutely, right. Individual. Yeah.
Yeah, see, you know what I stress all the time. It's like, you have no idea what the friction of difference is. Wait till you're actually personal, okay? Your personality is absolutely unique. It doesn't overlap one iota with anything else. There is absolute friction with everything else in the core of your personality, that absolute dimension. Right, because your personality is absolutely unique, absolutely apart from anything else. You know, it takes super absolute effort to bridge the gap, right, that they're referring to here, disagreement and friction. The more personal you are, the more present that really is. Right now it just appears there's friction. Wait till there's really friction, okay? You know, and see, that's, you know, if personality didn't produce this, you'd get to Gerasim and you'd be done.
Yeah.
No, getting to, you know, becoming a Gerasim citizen, it's like now you are a definitive Marantxa personality and all of the inherent friction is present. We need to take you up to socialize you to constellation level. Start bridging this divide. Everywhere you turn, you know, every personality is grating on you initially. Right? It's like, oh, that is just like so not. Right? Right now, you're protected from that harshness because of genetic commonality. Right? You know, we call what's actually temperament, personality. And there's pools of temperament, right? Because there's genetic similarity. And we seek out those pools of like temperament where the genetic friction goes away. Right? The point of the mansion world, is to get you out of that pleasant starting point where you can find comfort in genetic similarity and get you personalized, transcendent of that initial commonality.
What did you guys do to me? This is so
messed up. See, just think, is that not just like the exact opposite of what humans have always thought? See, we're 180 degrees turned around, and it's all kind of things that are in the same spirit as, pardon the pun, as spirit is innately divine. Mm-hmm. It's like, no. Not only is spirit not innately divine, personality just, makes the issues all the more problematic. Purposed spirit now.
Yeah.
It's not innately co-purposed with anyone. Yeah. Right? The line that your personality is on, no one else is on that line. Right? There's an infinite number of, ways that you can go out from a point, right? And you're on one of those rays from that center point. Everyone else is on a different ray.
Like, who do you talk to? Does anybody get along?
Yeah, it's really heartening. They tell us we'll be annoyed with each other through the constellation level or something like that.
We rejoice that disagreement and misunderstanding are possible. See, like I said, miss the evil, right, the wrongness. I mean, it's not just here.
Yeah.
It is just not Havona. See, aren't you getting that? We are not talking about Havona here, where everything is naturally just hunky dory, right? Right. They're all personalities, but they're innately harmonized.
Perfection of purpose.
Right. It's all that harmonizing is all done for them, it's just, built into them.
There's a cost to disagreement, though. I mean, it's, to coordinate and harmonize, just to free up energy that is somehow held at abeyance by disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
There's a potential there.
Right. Yeah. Right, exactly. That.
If no attempt is made to overcome the disagreement, there's still an ongoing cost.
Yeah.
That's why they provide for leadership throughout.
Mm-hmm.
Situations.
To help with, you're trying to get to progress, but it starts effort, struggle, conflict. So it starts, you have to potentialize it. You have to potentialize the progress by getting to conflict, that tension, that differential. Right? And then you actualize that potential and end up with progress.
Chris, is Lamia Supreme Seraphim, do you remember?
No, we don't know exactly, how that works. She's obviously functioning right now as a voice in the garden, but if I don't know, you think maybe they do say something somewhere? All I remember is, they can serve in all those different roles, and so we have no idea what her history is. Let's see, let's wrap up here with this paragraph. Let's see, so we went through all of the disagreement and misunderstanding. Anything else there? That's right. I wanted to make a comment on the very end there. Because I kind of noticed a couple of people going, what are they speaking of? What a glorious universe in that it is personal and progressive, okay? Not merely mechanical, okay, you get that part, I'm pretty sure. Or even passively perfect. What do they mean there? Okay, it's one thing to just say there's no mind and it's all just matter in a machine. Okay, and then obviously it was made by this, you know, perfect machine maker, so it'd be perfect. You know, and they spoke of that earlier there. But the passively perfect idea, because what if you add mind? What if you bring in mind? Okay, and all that mind functions perfectly. Okay, that's another more complicated situation of having everything perfect. But now you have matter and mind. But see, it's passively perfect. Right? That reminds you, I bring this up occasionally, you know, your mind functions, but a person acts. Right? It's in contrast to actively perfect, it's passively perfect, right? So non-personalized, you know, minds, just entities, you know, instead of beings, right? You could imagine, you know, a universe filled with things and entities, right? And it all could be you could be just made passively perfect. Let's see that free will thing, right? And getting to active perfection. Wow. See how complicated that is. Right, the father can't snap his fingers. Right, I mean, he has no way to overrule your free will. Your free will is his free will that he divested himself of. You are like him in that regard, right?
Schizophrenic.
Right. So, I mean, you have to choose to actively synchronize. See, when all is said and done, it's fundamentally unnatural. What we're heading towards with the grand universe settled in light and life. Active perfection. Now, where every free will being is choosing just so. Not only in and of themselves, but relative to every other thing in being, right, that you have this complete synchronization with. You have to be holistically active like that in order to get the grand universe settled in light and life. A bunch of island universes of perfection doesn't get you anywhere.
See, the glory of that is what he's talking.
Yeah. All right. That's the glorious destiny. Of a number of things and beings that is completely beyond, you know, comprehension, all being actively perfect. Perfected. Okay. That's the exclamation points, you know, right? And to think in those terms. I mean, when you know that glorious destiny is there, do you think you could be a little patient right now? Come on, just a little bit, right? For that end, would you do it for that end?
Take a breath.
Right? They're trying to help us with that. If your ideals were better, it might be easier to be patient. Maybe part of the problems with your impatience is you have pretty pitiful ideals.
Even material.
Yeah, right. They don't have anything to do with spirit, right? It's material idealism, right? You actually could get to spiritual idealism instead of material idealism, you'd find that patience is more immediate. Because the only way to get to spiritual idealism is through the neck of the hourglass, the level of patience. Right? See, again, the fact that you have all these impatient peoples, well, how really spiritually conscious are they? Not very. Right? Okay, so, all right, so we're done with all of the details, basically, of the first garden. So next time we'll continue. They don't really sally forth; they sort of slog their way east over to the second garden, and we'll pick that up next time. And of course, then we'll we'll see what becomes of these two conceptions that we have here that were not part of the divine plan. Yeah. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.